Welcome to Between Two Rounds. My name is Tariq Waked, a partner at Type 1 Ventures. I'm here with another partner at Type 1 Ventures, Abdo Jonhash. Don't try to guess where his name is from. Hi, Abdo, how are you?
I'm good, Tariq. Thanks for having me. I see you every day.
You pay for half of this, so it's fine. I know everything about you, but tell the viewers like a little bit about you, how you got involved with Type 1.
Yeah.
You know, what makes you you?
Yeah, so, you know, born and raised to two Lebanese immigrants here in Los Angeles. Grew up in Los Angeles, didn't really have a reason to leave. I think the best way to kind of describe my trajectory into Type 1 was I graduated, I went to USC, and when I was at USC, I was creating a business with, you know, Sharif, right?
Yeah.
Sharif and I were creating a product integration media production company. And that kind of just took off, and it was super fun, and we kind of employed a lot of the film school, and it was just kind of like went from zero to something really quickly. And when we got to that point—
How old were you when you started this business with Sharif?
I think we were both 18.
Know anything about running a business at the time?
Or no.
You just go as, you just like—
No. It wasn't until years later when I entered private equity, I understood all the concepts in private equity. But I didn't, like, I understood what a balance sheet was, a P&L, and all these things.
I still don't understand what it
is. Like, I understood all these things and, like, costs, but I never really thought about, like, how it applies to, like, purchasing or investing in stock or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until towards the later years of running a business where that became a conversation.
You were just like a typical Lebanese guy, like, 100%. Make money.
100%.
It very was cheap, I said. I don't pay my employees, and then I sell the product.
Yeah, literally. No, it was, and Sharif's Egyptian, so it's kind of the same thing. But we both got together, and he was like an incredible VFX artist. He'll kill me for saying this, but like, I met him, and he was like, he just had like a can of Diet Cokes all over, like empty cans. He had an obsession with Diet Coke at the time.
I hate Diet Coke.
And I was introduced to him through a mutual friend at USC. And I just walk in and here this dude is just creating these like crazy graphics. And he was doing it like at that time, VFX and everything was still very manual. And it still is in a lot of ways, but it was very manual. And he was so talented and could just put together these video concepts very quickly. And I was like, yo, like, what are you doing here? And he's like, oh, international student from Egypt, come to USC. Just want to learn I want to make films. He was like very artiste. And I remember just getting together and I was like, understanding like his situation, which was his parents are paying crazy amounts of money to have him here. You're paying whatever, $50,000 to $60,000 a year. You're getting the school controls all of the content that you make. You can't have like guns in it, or you can't have any like crazy concepts going on. And you're forced to essentially give ownership to the school for every content you make. And immediately the conversation was like, how do we not do that?
Like, so he was doing his degree in film and VFX, and there was all these students that were also doing the same thing. And you were like, we can monetize this.
100%. My brain went straight to like, you're really talented. Like he was also just exceptionally talented, right? Like there's one thing to be like, you know, you had a bunch of buddies doing graphics and stuff. Like Sharif was just exceptionally talented.
And this was what, 2012, if I remember correctly?
Yeah,
2011?
No, 2011, yeah.
Before like Instagram.
Yeah, this wasn't very like, it was just like Instagram was still like those like filters, like those classic filters. And it wasn't like a high, like life's highlight reel like it is now. It was at the time very just
like, and I remember bland. You telling me that you went and like did product placement in a lot of the music videos and things like that. So you just had like a, you know, very standard business in VFX and you took advantage of a gap in the market and then you sold it.
Yeah. So then I was offered a pretty much buyout for my position. Sharif and I amicably turned it into what today is Thermal Nuclear, which now is Megaton, and we
Thermal
invest.
Nuclear. That's a weird name for an Egyptian guy to run his company.
Yeah, he has an obsession with nuclear bombs.
That's weird. cut that.
cut that out. No. He took that brand, did a bunch of stuff, kept going with that business, and that's when I was like, wait a minute, I sold a piece of this business and people are making way more money on it. And we took the brand and we explored investing. Actually, when we first took the Homage brand, my partner at the time.
So Homage was the company.
Yeah, Homage was the company. And then I kind of took that brand and my partner at the time was an investor. And he said, no, let's take it. let him take all the assets of the brand and let's focus on investing in entertainment tech. And I was like, oh, that's a really interesting concept. So our idea, so I spent like that whole year going around like trying to get my, like wrap my head around VR content, like just the future of entertainment.
Mm-hmm. How people consume content.
Exactly. And like short form content versus normal form content. And I kind of came to this conclusion that it ended up being a hardware problem. I mm-hmm. believed in VR. I believed in a lot of these things, but I realized very quickly that for as long as your hardware is bulky, inaccessible, expensive, all these things.
What like hardware are we talking about?
Our VR hardware, okay. Right? And VR
like Apple Vision goggles exactly. still to this day.
But even then, like we both are owners of the Apple Vision.
We used it for like 3 days.
Tarek and I tend to go and buy things. Well, he goes to buy something and then somehow I get convinced in the middle of him buying something
hey,
to buy it
as don't well. Don't blame me for our bad decisions, okay?
But so anyways, that's what happened there. Ended up doing a stint in private equity, worked for some big firms.
The funniest thing that I always heard about your story was you worked for 4 years building a company. Some guy came in, bought your company, yeah. and then made four times the money yeah, than you did.
Way more money.
Just because he bought.
Yeah. And it was kind of like an acqui-hire, so he just like used my skill sets to his advantage to make more money. And
you're like, how can I do that?
Yeah, that's exactly where it kind of came in. But also getting to know the private equity culture, and I don't want to make this podcast about ripping on that, but it's just it's a specific kind of culture, and it's very like value extraction, very smart for money making, but not founder friendly, and it never will be. And I think that, these growth equity, like my, before I got into the venture part of growth, like growth equity meant a very different thing. Mm. Growth equity meant like very sustainable cash flow businesses, founders that want to scale, but they're, you know, the way they look at hyperscale, like scaling has nothing to do with how technology companies look at scaling. And so we went down this, like I've gone through like a big exploration of like what growth actually investing means to a private equity guy and what it means to a venture guy and how they're just drastically different
right.
like theses. So yeah, there's a lot. And then it turned into just wanting to go back to founders and providing value. And I think when I met you, I was just getting back into like managing for venture outside of doing angel checks and a bunch of stuff I did on my own. And I think I worked for somebody, Paige, who you know as well. And he taught me a lot of like what the venture culture is like. Like not a lot of people were open to having me join a venture fund. Like though I had – all they cared about me for was like, oh, you worked in private equity. You might have LPs.
Yeah.
They didn't really care to like – but to like teach me how to invest in venture. So I lost a lot of my own money.
They wouldn't give you a page out of their book.
No. Well, Paige did. And so Paige was kind enough to at least give me the time of day to like show me what
really good guy.
Yeah. What it means to like invest in venture. And he had a very specific style of working and all these things. But for me, what I learned the most was that they were doing pre-seed to Series A. It was very, very early stuff. I think when I entered any sort of business, it's always about like discovering the problems. And I can't help but look like at an early stage venture capital fund and think about the problems that exist for the founders, the problems that exist for the people trying to fund the founders.
Right.
So the way my brain works is that I looked at thematically what we're doing and I realized that all these companies are great. And a lot of the companies that we did were fantastic, but we did a lot of marketplaces and software
companies. At Outlander.
At Outlander. And I started to really just find like a lot of excitement around the hardware piece of those businesses.
And that's when we met, right? That's around that same time.
Yeah, exactly.
And I met on Clubhouse.
Yeah. So then I get this message from this dude, Tarek. I'm doing like this was like a weird time, right? Like
it's COVID.
COVID, yeah. COVID. And like I'm like out doing a walk and I'm just talking on this Clubhouse thing. And then I get a weird DM from this guy named Tarek Wakid, who's running Type 1 Ventures at the time. And Tarek, yeah, you're like, yo, I think, what did you say? You're like,
I don't know. It's something about Lebanese and you're in venture and you like space. And I was like, there's no way there's another person like that exists. Yeah. And you lived in LA.
Yeah.
And our moms had the same name.
Yeah.
Which we found out after.
Yeah.
But so when you first came across Type 1, having had private equity experience, founder experience, as well as some venture experience, What did you see, and how has that vision for what Type 1 can become evolved as you've been with us? Like, we've been together as partners for almost 4 years now, five years.
Yeah, it's crazy.
How have you seen the venture market evolve, and how has your vision for what we can become at Type 1 changed or grown?
Yeah, listen, I think that like one of the first, the thing that attracted me was like your ability when you were first starting to do what you're doing. I was like, who the hell is this dude? And how is he like Radiant and like all these like super deep tech, hard tech businesses that you're showing me? And I was like, that's like the flow I wanted to see. So outside of just like the brand itself, you were just showing me things that I was like, yo, this is like, these are the types of things I want to see, these massive infrastructure, super, I mean, like,
yeah,
the way
very risky.
The way you have to underwrite them early on is just crazy.
But well, you're betting on 20 companies and one or two could become the next big thing.
Yeah, but these are like visionary companies. Like, they truly are just, we're from start to finish, we're building infrastructure, you're vertically integrating their manufacturing. Like, these are just like crazy ambitious projects. And I was like, yo, they, like, in my opinion, these are the companies that are going to like be the next S&P. These are like
potentially,
potentially, like, these, whatever, one of these 15, 20, 30 companies are going to be the next Teslas, right? And so it started off with that specific reason was why even like working together got my attention, because I was like, these are really hard companies to do, and if you're not in network and space and all these things, that, like, you don't really know how to source these things. So you did an incredible job like getting that network together. And it's quality deals, people from NASA, all these things. So that was like the first like perfect thing. And then I saw like, you know, Type 1 and the meaning behind it. It was super cool. It's like science fiction-y, but it's also got an elegance to it. I don't know how to describe it.
It was just countless hours of YouTube and going down the rabbit
holes. Yeah, but I could tell it was thoughtful, right? Like, it was thoughtful. And what I thought was important about it was the versatility of it, meaning like, I know capital formation really well. If I know anything about this business, it's like how the money moves.
What do you mean? We always talk about capital formation, but for everyone that doesn't know what that means, how do you describe what capital formation is and as it pertains to venture capital?
Yeah, I think I'd actually flip the words and say it's the formation of capital, meaning the formation of money and how it revolves around a certain investment.
There's a guy here, there's a guy here, a girl here that has money. There's an opportunity. You have to be the conduit.
Yeah, exactly.
It forms around that idea.
Well, so much of our business now is like, you know, how many times are we like, how do we get into these deep channels of like wealth managers and things like that? Like, that wasn't things we're thinking about. Originally, our obsession became like, hey, let's invest in really cool companies.
Well, I remember the first time you came into our office, we had a first fund, no management fees. It was me and Daniil. We had a view of a brick wall. And you're like, how are you guys surviving? And I'm like, yeah, we'll figure it out. You're like, let's do this deal and let's make money. I'm like, and you're like, do this. And then I did what you said and we made a bunch of money. And I was just like, oh, like, this is nice.
Weird.
Yeah. You don't have to wait 10 years. But ultimately, those resources allowed us to grow the firm and build it what it is today. From that moment when you first joined Type 1 till now and how you've seen the venture ecosystem evolve, what is your vision for Type 1? And where do you think we're going as a firm? How would you, in an ideal world, what would it look like?
Yeah, I think where we really differentiate, like in the world of products, and I think one thing to be very cognizant about just building a venture product is like there's a lot of competing products. I think if we retain the vision of actually trying to achieve a Type 1 civilization, we differentiate ourselves in nature. And so the same reason that I got excited about the brand is the same reason why I think the brand is so – it's going to be so durable, like the longevity's there. And I think the definition of Type 1 require, like to actually achieve a Type 1 vision, it requires space, it requires manufacturing, it requires hardware, energy, the future of energy, like it requires all these theses.
There's convergences of technologies that are required to really get to that goal.
Exactly. And I think that what the vision that I have for it, right, is we're going to get to a place where we become so significantly knowledgeable across all these industry verticals that we're going to have like incredible positions and incredible like have backed like the best companies that are literally helping us progress towards that long-term vision. And that's going to require like energy companies, that's going to require space infrastructure, that's going to require like all of these different things. And I think if by the time where we get aged out, because we know in venture, like eventually partners get aged out, we've done a good enough job building that.
But the stress levels we have very soon, yeah. I'm getting a lot of gray hairs.
I think in 2 years, Tariq, when we decide to leave this thing, no, just kidding, investors, we're not doing that.
Three.
Yeah. I think by the time we get to that point, the next generation is going to have like enough of a foundation that you, myself, Sanjeev, everyone that's building it, we build this and then they have a great platform to continue to innovate towards that long-term
goal. I think for me, that was always the vision. It was like, how do we build a platform? Because you know, we're outsiders to venture capital. What I had seen and why I think it aligned so well with when we partnered up was there was this like club that you had to get invited to, and there are certain norms of how venture capital is done and how you raise money or who you invest in. And I see all these great founders that weren't raising money from the traditional venture funds or didn't know how to speak the lingo or the language. So we wanted to build a platform that was welcoming to outsiders. And then I found space. And again, space was this thing where if you didn't go to you weren't at NASA and you were an outsider, you don't get invited. It's like, screw you. We're building our club.
Life is just one long journey to break into networks that don't want them.
Hey.
But in a great way, because I have a similar approach. Yeah. It's like, dude, think about how much of a pest I'm on the wall with the companies I really want to invest in.
Oh, people hate you. Yeah, people exactly. Either love you or hate you.
Exactly.
But that's the Lebanese way.
Yeah, exactly. We just force ourselves into a room. No, and I think that's a little bit of our brand, dude, right? Like, I think the way that we've kind of come up, I mean, I would put my money on this. I don't think there's a single brand, and this is not to pat our own backs, but like, I don't think there's a single brand that's growing as fast as we are in the venture world. And we see that because we're met with opposition from you know, legacy firms that just don't want to give us the credit, right?
And we want to work with them.
Yeah, it's nothing against them. Like, we're always going to shake their hands and smile and be like, hey, cool. Like,
but there is a lot of politics in VC that I wasn't aware of, and we're starting to learn.
That's very
cool. It's like, it's very political, right?
It's very annoying, yeah.
Where do you think that comes from, the VC politics, and why?
I think it's like any transition of power, right? I think like when you think about, and it's politics is like so universal. It doesn't matter what industry you're in. And I think when there's a certain amount of people that feel like, you know, and they rightfully so earn their positions of power in those industries, sure. I think they try their best to retain it, and are less, you know, are less receptive towards like change.
Right.
And I think like we kind of looked at this industry and if you feel like we did this a different way, like please interject. But I think we kind of looked at this industry and we're just like, we're kind of both scalers. We're both kind of guys that are like, how do we do this faster, better, quicker, more efficient? And I think it's like our blessing, but also potentially our curse.
It's funny. Every time we encounter a problem, what do we say? Make more money.
Make more money. Spend more. Build it faster. Whatever. Like we always kind of have this mindset of just like, throw force at, like, if the door's blockading, throw force at it.
And you know, I've been dealing this with a lot of like the early stage portfolio where companies, we help them like tell the story. Like a VC, I think, helps the companies tell the story in a way that it's digestible. You become you spearhead your companies, you hold the torch up for them and you attract that capital around them or the resources they need, whether it's people resources or money resources. But then I see these companies get the resources, but then move really slow because they're trying to optimize for risk. They're like, oh, let's do the things the riskless way as possible, but they end up moving very slow. And I lose conviction for them in that sense. What do you think companies can do to execute faster and to like continue to build that momentum?
Yeah, I guess there's a couple comments to that. I think your style, like the founders you marry yourself really well to, just from observing, are the guys that are thinking about scaling. Like, how do they build something to scale? I think when you run into friction is when you feel like a founder's like excited about the technology, but he's not really like he's not a cavalier, you know. And there's useful cases for all types of those. You know, there's different founders and there's different like formulas that make a company successful. But I think I've noticed that you like the cavaliers. You like the guys that are like, let's get on horses and fucking build this thing, right? And I'm kind of the same way. Though I'm looking at companies a little bit later stage, I still look for inherently a startup is a startup until it's fully de-risked, meaning until it's like technically positive EBITDA and it's like a business that sustained itself. There's customer retention. Like
that even, is even when you get to positive EBITDA as a standalone business, you still have risk.
You just transition customers. And that the risk changes in private equity, which is like customer concentration risk, like future of the market risk. Like there's so many things like what, how do you compete? Right. And what people don't realize is startups are startups up until they go, you know, Series C, sometimes Series D, right? Even then it's arguably a startup, right? But I think what's important for the way I look at it is like when I look at founders, I look at vocation. Like that's the most important thing to me. It's like why of all things in the world that you could be doing right now, is it this you're doing?
Mm.
Like why the hell do you give up?
What's the best answer you've ever heard to that question?
Honestly, the more frustrated answers. Like I really love Oleg's reason. He was like, this is just such a stupid problem and it's frustrating. So I want to build homes faster, right? Like things like that where it's like, where it's just like, it comes from like, just like I've identified a problem and now I realize that it's such a massive problem for people that like and no one's going to do it unless I do it.
The best story I ever heard you tell about Oleg and Kubi was when Oleg was at a partner meeting with a VC and the VC asked him about TAM. Tell the story.
Yeah, so we have this company that we love these guys, but Oleg's an incredible engineer and he went to a
partner. What does the company do?
They build manufacturing facilities in proximity to major developments for single family residences.
So they build homes.
They build homes like very fast, like one home a day out of this factory.
Okay.
And so the idea is they're going to roll out all these factories around the US and they're going to do it. So he's at a meeting with the VC and, you know, granted, like the construction industry and thing has not been nice to VCs, right? So I understand like every tier one's hesitation. They've lost a lot of money. But they're sitting at this meeting. This partner goes, so what's your like, who's your customer? And
what do you say?
Oleg looks back at the VC and he goes, where do you live? And the guy goes,
a house?
Yeah, exactly. The guy goes, a house. And Oleg goes, exactly. They did not invest. In fact, like Oleg kind of has that personality where
there's a set of founders that want love VCs and always want to raise money. And there's a set of founders that have a negative perspective on VC. Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I think that, you know, I think it's for another problem that I really hope we solve in type one, which is like the buck stops with VCs. Like it is very hard to find a VC product that is valuable to a founder throughout the life of their business.
Yeah, everyone talks about value add.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
But everyone claims it. But what does like value add really mean? And the best value add that I think VCs ever get or like founders ever get from VCs are really on a personal basis, right? The same way like Gravitics and Tariq, right? You have like stuck your neck out for this company since day one. You've like call in his storytelling, like there's no way to spin it. Like Tariq's around, like Tariq, his name's in that origin story.
For better or worse.
Whatever, right? That's the risk we take.
Yes.
But it's like that you've integrated yourself into that narrative. And I think that the best relationships in VC start that early in a lot of ways.
But you can't scale those things, right?
Yeah. Well, then what happens is then your founders have to move on to what matters to them at that stage. So how do you build a platform that provides like how do you create a buffet for VC, right? Like how do you create a platform that feeds your founders across everything you need? And there's firms that are trying it. I would argue that a good one is A16. They're trying that. They have operating partners. They have all this stuff. It's a very
platform is key.
It's platform is key. Very challenging, but it's about retaining like the individual. I think so much about VC is that personal relationship you have with your founder to your investor, the guy who championed the deal inside that VC. I talk about this a lot, but it's almost more important for founders to know who they're in, who's investing them on a personal level than it is what brand or firm it is. And so I see that playing such a big role. But I don't know how you think. How do you think about it?
I think value add is hard to scale. And I always try to figure out as we grow as a firm and more people join the our firm, how we can systematically scale a platform. Yeah. And I think it's difficult because it's so individual. One thing I heard from Eve Cicerone, who started Upfront Ventures, it's always stuck with me. He goes, a VC is nothing but individual contributors. And a VC firm is individual contributors under one roof. And having those individual contributors support each other makes them better than the sum of their parts. Mm-hmm. And so how do you build a VC firm that can attract the right people, whether they come and go or whether they stay with the firm for a long time, that can add value to the portfolio, not in a systematic way, like here's our suite of products that you can leverage when we make an investment.
You don't want that.
But like, you need a customer intro, I can go get a customer intro. But that's like continuous legwork, and that's a lot of support for the portfolio companies. I can do that 5 to 7 times. You can take 5 to 7 board seats, and your bandwidth is pretty much done.
I mean, I don't even know how you do that. You could take 5 to 7. That's like superhuman. I could probably take 2 or 3. Like
exactly. Yeah, like depends. Yeah. Like how good can you be supporting X amount of companies? And so, at a seed round, you stay on a board or you support a company until they get to Series A or B, and then somebody else takes over, a different VC firm that leads. So I think it's going to be a challenge for us to continue to do our platform work systematically.
Yeah.
But hopefully we have the right people around the table.
Yeah, and I think we'll iterate it. And I think, like, honestly, I think it's just more about the culture we instill in the individuals. Because I think if we think about both of us, like if I see you, though we might not be doing it on the same deal all the time, though you're like, you're knee deep in a deal and you're like knee deep with these founders on doing something, I see that we do have similarities, and the similarities are
sometimes neck deep.
like we will just indulge ourselves in trying to find a creative solution for that company. And I think we just have to inspire our next set of principals or our next set of partners that you gotta be very creative. Like you gotta be very creative in the way you support your companies.
I think one thing I've been really focusing on with our team is I want to see people build conviction in deals and not wait for our like opinions of others to dictate where they, like Gustav does that really well.
Yeah.
Where we both passed on this company.
He just came in
and he just like showed. Yeah, he just showed up before our flight and he's like, guys, before you leave, we need to do this deal.
Yeah.
And we're like, no. And you're like, he's like, yes, we need to do it. And we're like, okay, shit.
And we're just like, well, wait a minute. I mean, he also did incredible work prior. So it's like this guy has made the fund a lot of money. So.
And on that note, I think allowing people to build that conviction and not have a unanimous vote to make an investment is where the alpha will lie.
Yeah.
I hate to see when VC firms have to get everybody convinced on a deal. It's like, ultimately, if everybody sees it, it's not an opportunity anymore.
Yeah.
I agree.
I like, and like, I think I'm like kind of a rigid personality sometimes, but I actually like to be wrong a lot. And what I mean by that is I like people to prove me wrong, right? Because it makes it fun. Like it makes it fun to be wrong. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's like when I'm like convicted that something's not going to work.
You're having fun all the time.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just like, my investment style is to do everything I say or to let everyone do everything I vote against, right? I think that so much about this business is actually being wrong and just structuring.
Well, look at it mathematically. If we're investing in companies that have one portfolio of 20 companies in a fund, maybe two will be right. That's a 10% success rate. You better be, if I always say, you can't hit a home run if you're not willing to strike out. And so when underwriting, you have to be okay with a 10% success rate. But like, it's really hard for, like, it's against human nature to do something when there's only a 10% chance of winning. Even in blackjack, you have 50% chance of winning.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you know? All right, tell us a fun story at Type 1. Your most obnoxious, outlandish story, and then a fun story. They could be both the same.
I feel like those are probably two of the same. The most outlandish story at Type 1, Tariq, we get one a day. I work with you.
We can cut it if it's bad. So just.
I think, honestly, the most recent one, and Cynthia's going to love this one, but. Is when you walk into I'm just sitting and chilling, like, just this is right before we're thinking about Bonka and all the stuff we're doing there. And you just come running into my room. You're like, dude, we're going to have dinner on the moon. And I'm like, Tarek, there's no fucking way we're going to have dinner on the moon. Like, what do you mean? He's like, no, dude, just moon, tables. And then like halfway through the conversation, I think someone calls you or something. You just storm out. And I'm just like thinking to myself, I'm like, and I'm like, all right, whatever. I go back to business. And then I like stop 5 minutes later. I'm like, dude, is this just like my normal daily encounter? Just like Tarek.
But we did. We went to the moon.
Yeah, no. They ended up doing it a beautiful dinner setting at the thing. And there's a moon on the table that I think all those got wrecked. Are they in the middle of the ocean?
They're somewhere? In Belgium right now, right?
In Belgium. Yeah, what did we do with those?
So the story, so everyone's aware, we did an event in Lake Como called the Frontier Formal. And we rented out this villa, and we wanted to do a big event. And CJ and I budgeted it out, and Abdo's like, "That's a big budget," and we're like, "It's fine,
responsibly."
It's a very budgeted. It was out. A very yeah. responsible budget. Yeah. And the whole idea from the Frontier events is we like to do a place where people can get together, whether it's investors, founders, people that are interested in space, outsiders to the industry, and see the companies, see their hardware, get to meet them. So that you can capital formation, right? Mm. But this one was a little extravagant because it's Lake Como. But the tables were in a tent that had a moon hanging, and it looked like you were on the moon.
They're inspired by the craters of the moon, but they looked like UFOs, honestly.
What do you think will be the most outlandish thing we ever do?
Dude, I'm not excited for those moments because I'll have more gray hair than I have. But yeah, so I think we have a lot of outlandish stories is my point.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, I think we have a lot.
So for all the founders out there thinking if you should partner with Type 1, we will fight for you.
Yeah, we will literally
fight. We will go to war for you. Abdo, it's been a pleasure working with you for the last 4 years. I hope this is decades more to come. There's never a dull moment.
It is true.
And so, you know, excited to see what we can do together, continue to do together. Wish Sanjeev was here so we can make fun of him being bald. We love you, Sanjeev. But
thanks. And I'm proud of everything that you're doing with this podcast and stuff. So I'm excited to be on it, and I'm excited to just continue growing, man. It's
yeah,
gonna be awesome.
Let's see, where can we get to Type 1 civilization in 50 years?
Oh,
30 years.
75.
We'll see.
We'll see. All right.
All right, thanks guys.
Thanks guys.